Hi everyone, I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today is a next level day at Second Life because I have a legendary chef, baker, restaurateur, and author in the studio with me. She is the winner of the James Beard Foundation's Outstanding Chef Award, which is the industry's highest honor, and a true national treasure and pioneer, the one and only Nancy Silverton. Nancy is the brilliant chef owner behind many award-winning restaurants, including Osteria Mozza, which is one of my favorite places in the world, not to mention the founder of La Brea Bakery, a hugely influential company that is pretty much responsible for introducing America to artisanal bread. She's also the founder of Nancy's Fancy, an incredible line of gelati and sorbetti. The salted peanut butter is a personal weakness of mine. I can't even keep it in the house. I am so excited to talk to her about the journey from pastry chef to empire owner. Now, on Second Life, it's Nancy Silverton. So, Nancy, on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning. So, what did you study in school and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
Well, according to my senior yearbook, I was going to be a lawyer.
Really?
Yes.
Did you have any sort of specific aspect of the law that interested you?
My father was a lawyer, and nightly at the dinner table, my sister and I were entertained by stories about his clients or his days in court, and thinking that at age 17, I needed to know what I was going to do for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. That's something I knew about, so I thought, I'll be a lawyer myself.
So how long did that last?
That lasted probably into my second week in college.
That long?
Yes. Back in those days, and I'm not sure how it is anymore, but back in those days when you applied to a college, you also had to talk about what your major would be. So I decided my major would be political science. Mm-hmm. It seemed like it kind of went hand in hand with being a lawyer. Mm-hmm. So I entered as a political science major, and I chose my classes within that major. And after being at school for a couple of weeks, I learned that inside that college was the Hutchins School, where they had maybe a dozen students. And each class was a seminar. It was the liberal arts school within the college. And so I quickly switched out of poli-sci and transferred into the Hutchins School.
Got it. Okay. So then at what point did you realize that you were A, interested in food, and B, actually start cooking? Was that a part of your childhood as well, or something that you developed later?
No, developed right around that same time, moving up to the newly opened dormitory at my college. The school had been around for a while, mm-hmm. but they did not have on-campus living. So they were new dorms that opened up with a very ambitious dining element to it. Mm-hmm. And one of the cooks, who was also a student, happened to be incredibly attractive. And I developed a crush on him immediately, so much so that I got the courage to walk up to him and tell him how much I love to cook, which was not true. He was also heading the vegetarian arm of the dining program there. So I told him I was a vegetarian, which I wasn't either. And I'd love to cook in the kitchen. And he hired me. I didn't get paid. What I got was half off of my dorm fees. So that was perfect. And I started cooking. I bought a cookbook. I still have it.
Which one?
I don't even know if it's in print anymore, but it is called Cooking Creatively with Natural Foods.
Wow.
And it was very, very simple and gave recipes that were almost non-recipes, but I needed them because I did not know my way around in a kitchen. So anything from steamed broccoli with way too much cheese melted on and then sprinkled with sesame seeds to a very dense and unappealing lentil loaf. But anyway, I was in charge of, I think it was dinner a couple times a week. But what happened, aside from the fact that I did go out with the boy for a while, because that's always everybody's question when I tell the story. So whatever happened with that. So we did have a romance.
It worked out.
And we still are friends to this day.
That's amazing.
But I loved working in the kitchen. I loved using my hands. Mm-hmm. I found a great – my mother always said to me that she knew that I loved to work with my hands, but I never found the right medium that I was comfortable with. So I tried to paint, and I thought I was terrible. She thought I was fantastic. I tried to sculpt, and that kind of didn't work. But I guess that sensory pleasure that I got from using my hands was really fulfilled in the kitchen. But also what was really fulfilled was the joy that I received from people loving my dry lentil loaf. I think that is one of the pleasures. I think that's definitely one of the pleasures that keeps cooks cooking is that—
The feedback loop.
The feedback. The feedback that someone gives you a huge smile or throws their arm around you and says, I love that, or that was great. You know, it gives you such satisfaction. And so for me, I look back at that dorm experience and whatever that fate was, but it was definitely meant to happen. There's no question that I found my calling early on in life, and it's something that people that do find their calling take for granted that everybody does not always find it. And it was such a clear moment to me to this day when I was standing in this sort of very antiseptic kitchen, a lot of stainless steel around me, but I just remember thinking, oh, wow, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
So at what point did you decide to go to cooking school?
That came a few years later. And you have to remember, this is back in 1974. So back in 1974, there was no such thing as a celebrity chef. There was nobody that was really talking about food. There was no sort of cachet about being a chef or a restaurant owner. There was none of that chatter. But I knew I wanted to cook. And that's where my dream stopped, is I wanted to cook. It wasn't, I want to own a restaurant one day. I want to own a chain of restaurants. I want to be a TV personality. I want to write cookbooks. It was nothing. It was just, I want to cook.
Simple.
Simple. And on the next summers, on my breaks, mm-hmm. I came back to Los Angeles and I got jobs at, and I'm putting this in quotes, French cafes.
Got it.
where the menu is broken down to omelets and salad niçoise and chocolate mousse, you know, and this seemed very exotic. And this
elegant.
Is what, and elegant, and this was what where people were eating. And so that's what I did the next three summers.
So you were preparing all of these non-vegetarian meals as well?
Right, mainly in the salad station.
So then why cooking school if you're already having some of that hands-on experience? Did you feel an internal desire to educate yourself, or did you feel like that was necessary to get to the next level in your cooking career?
Well, you know, to be honest, I didn't even know there was cooking schools around. I didn't know that that was something that you actually went to school or you could go to school or there were those schools available. But mm-hmm. when I decided to drop out of school— And this was in the second semester of my senior year. So if—
You were almost done.
I was almost done. As clearly as that moment of realizing this is what I want to do for the rest of my life in the dormitory kitchen, I remember sitting in the library and I was writing a paper for my last semester and I'm just not into it. And I'm thinking, you know what? I'll never do anything with this degree. I am wasting my evening tonight. I am not going to return to school. And I called my parents. And as I already said, my father was a lawyer. So that's a, you know, very prestigious profession. My mother, although she worked out of the home, she was a television writer, also very prestigious. Mm-hmm. Both could have heard me say that I was dropping out of school and they could have disowned me. They could have yelled at me. They could have punished, you know, anything because it was sort of a little bit irrational, and it is true. I only had a few months more to go. But that wasn't their reaction. There was a little bit of silence, and my father said, that's okay with me. but will you promise me that you'll go to the Cordon Bleu? Now, I
didn't His even, idea.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know how he knew about it, but he did. And he signed me up. Mm-hmm. And there was a year, almost a year and a half waiting list at that time. I went in the fall of 1977. So when I told him I was going to drop out, mm-hmm. I also let him know what my plan was. So I had given this some thought. Mm-hmm. And this is something else that I don't know how I got to this conclusion, but I thought, you know, I've spent these three summers in restaurants where I've been put into a position where all I've seen is the dishes that I've was taught to make. I want to see the whole kitchen. And the only way I can see the whole kitchen is if they're not paying me or if I'm not getting paid and I can apprentice there and work for free. So my parents agreed to support me, and I found what I thought was the best restaurant near where I was living. This is in Northern California. Mm-hmm. I was living in Sonoma County. So this restaurant that I chose to knock on the door and say, take me for free, was in Marin County. Mm-hmm. They took me on immediately, and that's what I did for a year and waited out until I was ready to go to
school.
I chose London over going to the original school, which was in Paris, because of the language. I didn't speak French.
Got it.
And it was a certificate course. I don't remember how long it was, 4 months, something like that. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't the way cooking schools are now. But it wasn't that long. And it was just the basic, the foundation of French cooking techniques.
Did you feel like you already had some of that under your belt, or were you learning things that you had never seen
before? No, I learned things that I never saw before.
Like what?
Well, I didn't know how to make a sauce. How about that? I didn't even know there was such a thing as mother sauces, you know? But all techniques. But in those days, it was just a basic French foundation of how to poach, how to sauté, how to roast, you know, the very basic. But the quality of the ingredients was not what it is today.
Hmm. So you spent your time in London, and then to fast forward a little bit, you came back to Los Angeles.
We went back to 464 Magnolia. That was the name of the restaurant. And we had talked about this before I left, and while I was at school, they were not open for lunch. They were a dinner-only restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they asked if I would come back, if I would be their lunch chef. So I came back for a year.
Wow.
And I was—
And does that mean that you made up all of the dishes?
Yeah, I was able to write my my lunch menu.
Was that intimidating or exciting?
No, you know, I think when you're young and cocky and overly
Were
confident—
Were you cocky?
Probably. I probably came back and I—and my head was big because
You're very
I
international now,
was international. I had lived in London. You know, I went there early and I stayed later, so I lived in London for 6 months. I had a certificate to prove it, and so I could do anything.
So you were the lunch chef.
So I was the lunch chef for a year.
Did you find that you were drawn to any particular aspect of cooking, whether it was like, oh, you loved, you know, the grill station, or oh, you love pastry, or did you like just love overseeing all of it?
No, I loved overseeing all of it. And the way the kitchen at 464 Magnolia was run was very similar to the way Chez Panisse was run in those days. We cooked out of cookbooks, but it was a restaurant that really tried to use local ingredients. Produce and the quality of the ingredients was utmost importance. It was an all-California wine list.
Very progressive.
One of my jobs was picking up, because I lived in Petaluma, the ducks from the farm in Petaluma, the same ducks that we use today at our restaurant.
Wow.
So yes, it was. It was very progressive. And I think my experience there with that produce and the few times that I ate at Chez Panisse really sealed the type of food that I wanted to cook. And that has really not changed very much. Mm-hmm. I think some of the dishes that I probably cooked at 464 Magnolia could probably be on my menu today.
That's amazing. So you spent a year there. And then how did you end up in L.A. working at Michael's?
So I spent the year as the lunch chef. And I felt like I kind of was outgrowing that experience and that restaurant. At that time in 1979, we're talking about, Los Angeles seemed like a much more exciting place to cook than Northern California. And one of the exciting places that opened up was Michael's Restaurant in Santa Monica. My parents had just been there the night before. A huge article had just come out in LA Magazine. I went there to eat and I loved it. And I told Michael, who I had met, Michael the owner, that I wanted to work there. And it was like, great, come in tomorrow and meet my manager, Carl. So I came in the next day. And of course, Michael hadn't told Carl I was coming in. So he had no idea who I was and what I wanted to even do. But he knew that what he wanted to hire me as a manager was something not in the kitchen, but something to help him out and alleviate one of his shifts, which was the lunch chef. So in the kitchen, there was a computer system, first of its kind in the country, I think.
This is 1979?
Yeah, Michael was very, very forward-thinking.
Wow.
He also had a computerized wine list, so he was able to keep that wine list up to date every single day, which was sort of unheard of. You know, you'd go to these fancy restaurants and you'd open up these big books
Bibles.
Of wines or Bibles of wine, and you would just see those Bibles being full of crossouts where certain vintages are, you know, no longer available. But Michael was very, very forward-thinking. So in the kitchen, on the side of the kitchen, sitting on a stool with a computer desk in front of me, the waiters would give me the order and I would type it into the computer, and then that rang out on the kitchen line. Mm-hmm. And that's what my job was.
How did you feel about that?
Well, to me, I was just so excited about getting a job there. And the chef at the time was Jonathan Waxman. He loves to tell everybody how terrible I was at putting those orders in. And I think maybe today that's why I still have never used a computer. Because just imagine, you put in the wrong order and the cook cooks the wrong
thing.
Item. Not only are the cooks screaming at you, but
getting it from both
customer,
sides.
Yeah, you're getting it from both sides. But Jonathan thought that this was what I applied for, you know,
right.
My dream job to work on a computer ordering, you know, food. So when he found out that that wasn't what I wanted to do, he was sort of relieved because I think he felt sorry for me. And he wanted to bring me in the kitchen. But the only place that was available was in the pastry kitchen. There was a very talented but very finicky pastry chef that Jonathan believed had one foot out the door. Anyway, Jonathan said, I want you to go into pastry. I want you to learn every single thing you can from Jimmy Brinkley because I think that
he's going to leave. Were you interested in pastry?
No. And not only
– no.
It wasn't that I wasn't interested. I was so afraid of it because at the Cordon Bleu, it was my least successful part of the meal. You know,
did it just feel fiddly to you or too
delicate?
Well,
it felt – I think that – a little bit, I have to say, in those times. I don't know how the Cordon Bleu is run now, but I think back in those days, it was run a little bit out of fear. Like, you got to stick to that recipe, and you've got to do it exactly the way that we're doing it. And there
is
no flexibility. Mm-hmm. And because of that, and because every time I started to make a dessert, I kind of shook. And I tried to do it exactly as they did it. But for some reason, I had so many failures. You know, my soufflés didn't rise high enough. My Bavarians didn't set. My crème anglaise curdled, you know. And it was mainly fear rather than a dislike. Mm. But just as I had decided to agree to work on the computer as a way of getting into that kitchen, at Michael's, I agreed to do desserts thinking I was that much closer to the hotline, but it wasn't going to last.
Right. So it just seemed like a stepping stone to get to where you wanted to be.
Yep.
And then did you fall in love with it? Did you?
I did. I fell in love with Jimmy, as a person, by the way. I fell in love with desserts. I fell in love with the idea that when you're in the pastry department, you're in your own separate world. And I love that. And I think that people that work in the pastry department, still in kitchens, it's the one department where everything that you do by yourself for yourself. Where in the kitchen, there's a lot more hands that go through the different processes mm-hmm. before it gets to you, meaning like there's usually a whole prep team that prepares a lot of the food that by the time the line cooks show up,
They're assembling.
I also love that we would start 4 o'clock in the morning. The kitchen was quiet. the kitchen was ours, because Michael's was then and still has a very small kitchen. Mm-hmm. So we had that kitchen. By the time lunch really got underway, we were gone.
So that's early hours, though.
I loved it, though. You know, I got to stay out until 1 in the morning, run home, take a shower, go to sleep for an hour, wake up, go in.
Yeah. Oh, you
those
plus
were the
passion.
Days. Yeah, right. Those
so
were the days.
So how long did you stay at Michael's, and what made you decide to move to your next project?
Well, I feel like I was there for a year-ish. Mm-hmm. That Michael and Jonathan decided to send me to France to go to pastry school. That sort of came about because there was an opportunity to go to a weekend class up at the Robert Mondavi Vineyards, mm-hmm. taught by Gaston Lanot.
Wow.
But it was so expensive, it was almost cheaper just to go to France, take more classes, get more education.
Wow.
And be in France. So they sent me to France, and I went to—
Is that common that people are just sent to France to go and learn from their job?
I think the opportunity for further education doesn't happen often enough, but it's not that it happens, you know.
Okay, but that's pretty special.
Even sending people to other restaurants to go learn, I mean, because in the end it would benefit.
Right, okay.
It would benefit them. I think what they said is, we'll pay for schooling, you get over there, pay for your living expenses, mm-hmm. and it'll be a win-win. So I went to Paris for 6 months.
Wow.
And I had, as you can imagine, an eye-opening, incredible time, and came back to Michael's. Mm-hmm. And I was there really only for about another 6 months. Mm-hmm. And this is when Spago, or the opportunity to be the pastry chef at Spago, came up. And that came up through my friend who ended up becoming my husband, who ended up becoming my ex-husband, was going to be the chef there. And so he didn't necessarily convince me, but convinced my mother that this should be my next step. I was really reluctant to leave Michael's. It was very safe. It's a very prestigious restaurant.
And
I
they
loved
had nurtured
working
you.
There. They nurtured me. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel like I was ready to be the pastry chef. And so—
But you did.
Through my mother, who said, you better do this, I kind of went a little bit kicking and screaming.
So you were in your mid-20s-ish.
Yeah, I was 28.
My point is you were very young to be the pastry chef, and Spago was the biggest deal in the world, certainly in Los Angeles at that time. I mean, I just remember—
But remember, it hadn't been when I—
But there was some heat around it.
No heat around it. I mean, Wolfgang definitely— I think Mommy's Own, which is where Wolfgang
yes.
had worked— at Michael's restaurant and a handful of others were the A-list, right? But remember, we're still talking early 80s where restaurants were still just restaurants.
And this became something that was so much more.
Became, right.
But you didn't know that when you were getting into
no.
it. So you said yes, though.
I said yes.
So how did you go about putting together the dessert menu at that point? And did you— When did you know that you had created something that was both popular and something that fulfilled your creative ambition?
Well, firstly, Wolfgang, you know, did tell me what he wanted, not as far as the desserts, but what he wanted to do with them. So there was something that was very popular at Michael's and at Mommy's Own, and I think it originated at a restaurant that was opened before both of them, which was L'Hermitage Restaurant. Mm. Something that they did that nobody else was doing is when you entered the restaurant, there was a dessert table, and all of their desserts were laid out on the table. And both Wolfgang picked up on that for Mommy's Own, mm-hmm. and Michael picked up on that at Michael's. And Wolfgang definitely wanted the desserts on display. But the way that Spago was designed, there was no room for that dessert table. So what he wanted was he wanted desserts that went around the bar. So because they were going to be showy and, you know, and from my experience at Michael's, I knew that they had to be decorated desserts. They had to be desserts that lent themselves to being left out for several hours. But I didn't want to do just what I was doing at Michael's. First of all, I needed to grow, but I needed to make a mark for myself. I built on what I learned from Jimmy. And what I learned from Jimmy is that he didn't make desserts that necessarily had a name. So back in those days, again, we're talking late 70s, early 80s, most of the restaurants bought their desserts from a handful of companies.
You're
so
kidding.
One was called, no, because
firstly, it was a luxury to have a pastry chef.
Not only was it a luxury to have a pastry chef, it was a luxury to have a pastry department. Plus, think about it. Since there weren't that many restaurants that had pastry chefs, there weren't that many people to fulfill those positions.
So you would just buy your desserts.
So people were buying desserts from a company called La Mousse. So a lot of people, if you looked at the desserts back in that time, you'll see a whole category of mousse cakes, you know, and what they were. There was another place called LA Dessert, something like that, mm-hmm. and they did a whole slew of pecan pies and apple pies and
like
things
American
like
that. Like American classics.
Yeah. And then I know there was a company that specialized in carrot cake. So, you know, I think there was three companies that everybody bought. But if you didn't find those standardized desserts, what you would find in a few restaurants that made their own pastries were classic French pastries. There were desserts that were recognizable by their title. Mm-hmm. So with Jimmy, all of a sudden we were making all these desserts where their title was what their ingredients were. So like chocolate raspberry mousse cake or, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you never saw that on menus before.
It's amazing. So as you started to put together the desserts for Spago, what was an early certainty or an early hit or something that you knew that felt like a Nancy stamp of approval on it?
Well, there was a couple desserts that Wolfgang definitely wanted on the menu. Mm-hmm. One was a very classic French dessert called the Marjolaine. So it's a series of different layers and fillings. Mm-hmm. So I kind of did my twist on that. And he also wanted a pecan pie because those were his two favorite desserts. So the pecan pie, all I really did, besides hopefully making it less sweet, maybe whole pecans instead of chopped pecans, mm-hmm. is I made them individual.
Oh.
And he loved that. But I think what I did is that when I come up with a dessert or work with creating whatever that finished dessert is, I just always take the same kind of elements into consideration.
Mm-hmm.
Besides the flavor of the ingredients and low on sugar and things like that, there always has to be texture. I really love the contrast of hot and cold,
mm-hmm.
creamy and crunchy, you know, those kinds of elements. I feel like so often when people make desserts, where they fail is they'll take one small bite and be satisfied with whatever it is that they created without taking into consideration a dessert or anything is made to be enjoyed eating a whole piece of. And sometimes that whole piece is not as enjoyable as that tiny bite. So to make something that's interesting and tasteful and not
– and continues to be interesting throughout the entire –
Yeah, and so that, I think, has always been what
– What guided
I've thought
you.
About. Yeah.
So you worked at Spago for a number of years.
I went there twice.
Mm.
I mean, I worked in two different stages. So I worked there for, I think, about 2.5 years,
mm-hmm.
And moved on to New York. So myself and my then husband were recruited mm-hmm. to work at a restaurant to try to kind of Californianize it a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved to New York. It was a situation that didn't work out. It lasted about, you know, close to a year. And then we came back to Los Angeles. Living in New York that year, I loved living there, even though I didn't do anything but work. Nothing but work, but I knew that it would be a city that would be fun to play in. And that's where I ideally wanted to open a restaurant. But when it came down to thinking about the menu and thinking about what was available at that time as far as produce, because
right.
we've always had a produce-driven, you know, menu – there was so little available.
Right.
It was like, you know what? There's no way we can open a restaurant in New York. We got to go back to Los Angeles. So we came back to Los Angeles mm-hmm. Knowing that we were ready to open our own restaurant or felt we were ready to open our own restaurant. And Wolfgang was kind enough to take us back knowing that we
were going to leave.
We were going to leave. And I came back and worked for a year plus.
Were you nervous about opening your own place? Because going from working in other people's kitchens to opening your own, I mean, that's a huge pivot, even if it might not feel like it, and thinking about capital and the money aspect of it. Did you feel prepared? Were you scared? Were you excited? Did you have a big plan? Or was it something that was guided by intuition and enthusiasm?
I think that I didn't have enough time to be scared. I didn't really realize at that time the riskiness of opening a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Did I feel ready? I didn't feel ready, but I was in a situation where I was married to a chef who wanted his own restaurant. I think probably if it was up to me, and because I got along with Wolfgang so well, I probably would still be working for him. You know, I had no need to have my own place. But because I wasn't alone, mm-hmm. it sort of—
You have to make family decisions.
Made a family decision. Thank you.
Got it. I understand that. So how did you end up opening La Brea Bakery at the same time?
I wasn't planning on opening a bakery. I was planning – or we were planning on opening a restaurant.
Campanile.
Didn't have a name yet because it was the building that gave us the name. It had that
bell tower.
Metal tower mm-hmm. and we wanted to be sort of Italian inspired, and we were looking for a good Italian name, and the whole thing worked together. But when I went back to Spago that second time, because there was already a pastry chef, so it wasn't that Wolfgang needed. He just wanted to have me back to support the pastry chef. But for him, it was a great opportunity to do something that he hadn't done in the restaurant up until that time, and that was to try to create a bread program.
That's when you started baking?
Yeah, and not on a sophisticated level. He was very dissatisfied by like the one or two choices of bread that could be bought in Los Angeles at that time. And this was always his dream. When I was in New York, and the restaurant, by the way, was called Maxwell's Plum. Mm-hmm. Well, went back to work at Maxwell's Plum. Mm-hmm. And coincidentally, Jimmy was also in New York at the same time. He had followed Jonathan Waxman to Jams.
Got it.
Jonathan had left Michael's and went to open a California restaurant in New York.
Oh, that's amazing.
Jimmy followed him. So I worked for Jonathan because uh-huh. Jonathan thought Jimmy had one foot out the door.
Right.
And I don't know, 5 years later
they're
or something.
They're still together.
They're still together.
And on
but
the other
now
side of the
New
country.
York. Yeah. Jonathan sent Jimmy for a week-long stage uh-huh. at Acme Bakery, where Jimmy sort of observed, mm-hmm. got his hands wet in sourdough bread baking.
Wow.
And came back and started to bake a little bit for Jonathan.
At Jams.
At Jams, but then moved on to another restaurant that was called Sign of the Dove, mm-hmm. where he was making bread and I would go visit Jimmy.
Interesting. So while you're at Maxwell Plum, you're visiting Jimmy and he's starting to make bread.
Yes.
So is that what sparked your interest in bread?
It kind of sparked my interest. Mm-hmm. But really what sparked my interest in bread was when I went to France mm-hmm. to go to Le Note, mm-hmm. the bakery Poulain.
Oh.
That sparked my interest. When I ate the bread at Poulain, I kind of filed somewhere in my head, one day I'm going to try to make something like this.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know how to get there, but I just knew one day. Anyway, having Jimmy's bread at Sign of the Dove mm-hmm. was the closest I had had to Poulain bread. I leave New York, go to work for Spago. Mm-hmm. Wolfgang tells me about this wild idea he has about starting a bread program. And uh-huh. it was like, wow, here's my chance. Somehow, I got a hold of Jimmy. He gave me some starter.
Wow.
Right. And
That originally from Acme?
No, he made his own.
He made his own.
Yeah.
Okay.
They had sort of talked him through how to make a starter,
right.
which he talked me through, and that's how I eventually made my starter at La Brea Bakery. But before that, I just borrowed or took some of his starter and started to make. Wolfgang wanted two loaves of bread. He wanted a bread with olives, and he had just come back from some sort of a show in Germany where he was so excited by this bag of multigrain mix that he brought back that with a little water and a little fresh yeast, you could make those very delicious, heavy German grain breads. Mm-hmm. And those are the two breads that he wanted. So the easy one was following the recipe on the back of the package.
Right.
And that was our grain loaf. Uh-huh. The one that was a little bit more challenging was sort of teaching myself how to make a sourdough olive loaf.
Right.
And I don't even remember what those two loaves were like. But I just remember the difficulty of trying to make bread in the corner of a restaurant kitchen, fighting for space in a walk-in. And as I saw how popular this bread that we were making at Spago was,
people responded to it tremendously.
Tremendously. I thought, you know, when we're looking for a restaurant space, if we can find a space that's big enough that I could have a separate bakery, maybe I too will make bread at my bakery. I knew that I didn't want this bakery to be miles away because I knew how time-consuming it would be just being a restaurant and then also having to operate a bakery if I had to travel between the two. So it was only if we had found a space that was big enough for the two.
And how fortuitous that you did.
Well, not at first. We first sort of narrowed down where we wanted to be. Somehow I wanted to be in what became the location of Campanile. So I don't know what you call that, the east side, mid-city, whatever
mid-city.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
It was an affordable area. I didn't even think about Santa Monica. Downtown Los Angeles didn't exist.
No.
I was from the San Fernando Valley. I didn't want to be there, you know.
Yeah.
So where that area was kind of – I was first looking on Melrose because this was the trendy place to be. But what I didn't like about Melrose was that the spaces were small, meaning that I felt like when people moved into them, they were not committed and there was so much turnover.
Mm.
And then La Brea, which was just so close, at that time had a lot of car dealerships that occupied big chunks of land. So, you know, they eventually did move, but you felt like they weren't moving.
Right.
And so there was a little bit more permanence.
Right.
So that's where we started to look was on La Brea. And we found a location around Beverly and La Brea.
Mm-hmm.
So further north than
you were. Mm-hmm.
Than we ended up. And what I loved about the space, it was a great building. It was an Art Deco building. And you know, I was looking for, again, a building that felt like there was some history to it. There was some charm, character. Yeah. So the landlord was Julie Newmar.
Wow.
Right. So loved the space. So we started to negotiate. And it just so happened that Mercury was in retrograde. And I didn't know this, but when Mercury goes into retrograde, you don't talk business.
Well, so. you have to slow it all down. My business partner and I used to not sign contracts when Mercury was in retrograde.
Right.
Or
well, that's
you just,
it.
Like, slow it down.
So she couldn't sign.
Got it. So she really believed.
Oh, so she really believed. Mm. So we got, you know, whatever it was, we got into the negotiating up to the signing of the contract and everything had to come to a halt.
Which it's like 6 weeks.
Gave us, right. But I think very soon into it, my mom and my dad were driving around and they ended up driving further south on La Brea and they went beyond 6th. And right there on the left-hand side was this building for lease or for sale. But if you had gone to Campanile or now go to Republic, you know that that building was not only big enough for a restaurant and a bakery, but I also lived upstairs for the first few years. And so that's how La Brea Bakery and Campanile
came together. What was the beginning of La Brea Bakery like?
So what I decided was that I wanted to open a bakery where I could at least offer 6 loaves or 6 varieties of bread. I felt like Angelinos kind of liked variety. They wouldn't understand if I had only 1 type of bread.
Mm-hmm.
But 6 seemed like it was enough to draw attention and that hopefully I could figure out these 6 loaves of bread.
What were the 6?
So I wanted to do a baguette.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to improve on that olive loaf.
Right.
I improved on that multigrain loaf by moving beyond the mix and actually making mine from scratch.
Uh-huh.
I had just what I called a country white.
Mm-hmm.
I know I did a whole wheat, and I believe the other one was a olive oil rosemary, and I also did rolls.
Okay. That was what you opened with.
That's what I opened with. So what I did was I realized, okay, I signed a lease on a bakery, and I don't even know how to really make a loaf of bread. I know how to make a loaf from a mix, and I'm very challenged by the other ones. I better go figure out what to do. So Linote offered a bread making class. Mm-hmm. So I signed up for that and I went off to back to school mm-hmm. for the 5-day class in bread making. And what was challenging was that when I went for pastries there and I took, I think, 6 classes spread out over like 6 months. But I was so familiar with baking terms, the language didn't get it in the way. I still didn't and don't speak French. Mm-hmm. But bread was just a mystery. So it was really, really challenging. But what I walked away with was a book of recipes, and that was it. So I still left France with the confidence that I will take these recipes and I'll just duplicate them. And what I learned on day one, that a loaf of bread is not a chocolate chip cookie. I mean, there are so many variables. It's living, the flour matters, the air matters, the water hours, you know, yeah. everything matters, that everything I put into the oven came out a disaster.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was terrifying. And then I had to start at the beginning. And I had to firstly pick what kind of what flour I was going to use. I didn't even know. You know, you go to the supermarket and there's all-purpose flour mm-hmm. and there's whole wheat flour and there's cake flour. Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about flour. I didn't understand all the nuances. I didn't understand anything about wheat. And back in 1986-ish, mm-hmm. 7, there weren't the bakers to talk to, and there certainly weren't the books to read. I remember I right away bought the breads of France from Bernard Clayton. Mm-hmm. I tried to make a few loaves out of his book, Disaster. I bought, you know, Julia Child's had a 20-page recipe on how to make a baguette. I tried them all, and they were all failures. But other than that, there weren't the books like there are today. I mm-hmm. mean, today there is no excuse to open a bad bakery. You know, all cooking schools teach bread classes, right? There are so many fantastic books on the market. There are so many knowledgeable bakers to knock on their back door, you know. But that wasn't true back then. So I thought, okay, I'll stick to one type of bread. I'll stick to a white bread. I'll stick to a baguette. And I'll start bringing in all these different flours with all these different properties. And even though they'll all be bad, one will be less bad than the other. And that's really what I did. And I just started changing things a teaspoon at a time, you know, or a pinch at a time.
Wow. That's very methodical. Is that a through line in how you tinker with recipes in general, or is it where it's just small change? Like, were you writing all of that down?
Oh, yeah, and I have those books, and it's funny to look at them, too. Well, I don't have the books of the early days. I have the books of when I opened the bakery and I was still perfecting.
Right.
And all the cross-outs and the changes, you know, it's really funny to look back at that. But I think, you know, because I was exposed to great bread. I was exposed to great bread first at Poilin, mm-hmm. and I was exposed to great bread because of the breads that we made at Linote. Mm-hmm. I knew the end result or what it should be. Had I just been thinking, you know, I'm going to make a loaf of bread and it's going to be round.
Fine.
Then probably, I mean, I would have stopped much sooner. But I have to say, looking back at how difficult those times mm-hmm. were, and how defeated I felt every single day. The flip side is how rewarding it was that I actually can say, I figured that out.
Right.
And also, I think, and I've told people this before, that because there was nothing that stopped me from trying a different method or technique, I tried everything. And I'm sure I discovered a whole lot of things that I wouldn't have discovered if I knew what I was doing. You know? So like, for instance, if I knew that scientifically you shouldn't put more than 30% of a starter into a recipe, then I would have stopped at that rather than pushing the limit. And that's what I did with everything that I did.
You tested all of the parameters.
Right.
So I've seen and love your episode of Chef's Table. And at one point, though, I remember just feeling so tired for you, thinking about the schedule of working at La Brea Bakery, baking all night, and then doing all of the desserts for Campanile and having a family. How did you get through that, and what was driving you to keep going? Because that seems like an insurmountable amount of work to have two full-time jobs and a family.
No, you know, there's no question that it was.
Did that last?
Like, it lasted the first two years because there was no choice, you know,
right.
And that's the thing. If you don't have a choice and you have to do it, you make it work, you know,
yeah.
And certain things you do, you don't give all your attention to as you should,
mm-hmm.
right? But I think it's one of those things that if someone was to say to me, okay, so you have a bakery and you have a family and you have desserts to be responsible. Now, obviously, I didn't do everything by myself. I had help. So let's, you know.
Still.
Okay. But ultimately, I was responsible. And if someone plotted it out and said, this is what's going to happen. You'll start your, let's say you're going to start your day as a baker. So you're going to start your day at midnight. And you're going to work until 8 in the morning, and then you're going to run upstairs and you're going to say goodbye to your kids, and then you're going to sleep for 2.5 hours. Then you'll be up at 10:30 because then you've got to start in the pastry department, but then you're going to get a nap at 4, but then you'll be back up at 6:30 so that you're ready to plate desserts. And then if you can at 10, maybe you can go back to sleep for 2 hours and then you'll go to the bakery. You'd say like, well, you know what? I really can't do that. I got to figure out something else
that
out.
That sounds insane.
But that's what the schedule was, and you know, you just did it.
Talk about startup life.
I don't think I'd want to do it again. And I think it lasted for about 2.5 years.
Wow. So delegation is something that we
delegation.
Talk about on this pod a lot, and it seems like you like to be very hands-on.
Right.
I have a hard time, especially with things that I love, with delegating. It's something I have to work on tremendously. How have you learn to delegate, and what do you feel comfortable delegating now that maybe you didn't in the past, and how did you get to that point? Because you can't touch every single thing all of the time.
And, you know, now, flash forward how many years later, now I feel like I'm a great delegator. And I think you have to be because you can't do it all. And you can't delegate and then micromanage. That's really, really difficult, and it's not constructive, and it doesn't help the people that you're depending upon grow. So one thing you have to realize is that most likely it's not – you got to let go that it's not going to be necessarily as perfect it is if you do it yourself, but you can't do it all by yourself. So it's not that you become less particular, but, you know, it's not that, but you have to realize that certain things are going to be out of your control. But
less
back
precious.
Then, it was very difficult for me to delegate, but I had to slowly. So, for instance, when the bakery first opened and I gave you some of those hours, it's because I mixed, shaped, and baked the bread. I think I gave up the shaping first, and that was really rough. And every time I had a loaf that I felt was misshapen or it was shaped too hard, you know, it was just very frustrating. And I'd have to go back to the bakers and I would have to show them again, you know. And then I had to give up the mixing, you know, because that baking shift, which I couldn't give up for 2.5 years, was so important to me because it was such – that was something that was very difficult to teach when the loaf was ready to go in. So finally, when I gave up the baking shift, and I only gave it up because by that time we had moved the bakery from that current location to a much larger facility on Washington Boulevard, and I was pregnant again with my third child. It was at that point where I just needed to delegate. Every morning I would go in and I would look at the bread and we would talk about it and I'd go back in and I'd fix it, and I didn't let go of it, but I had to delegate. And it was because of that that as we started to grow our business and make more and more bread, and we had interest in somebody buying our company, it was much easier for me to let go and sell it because I wasn't doing it by myself. I mean, that's why I opened a bakery. I opened a bakery because not only did I want to teach myself how to make a loaf of bread, I loved the process of making bread. And when I wasn't making it anymore, it's not that I loved it any less. It was just not as personal. It
gave you some distance.
Yeah.
So to that point, to skip ahead again, how did you feel when you sold Libre Bakery? Did you have enough distance on it that it felt like an exciting time to move forward?
Yeah, I was ready because it came in two stages. We recognized early on that we were too small to be bought out by a big company. So what we decided to do was to accept a relationship with an investment banker who put in a lot of money that helped us to grow to the next stage. No, Washington we were able to do on our own.
Got it.
I'm talking about this plan that we had to open a facility, which we did in Van Nuys, and now we have one in New Jersey, to be able to make bread that is par-baked and distributed now internationally. And we knew that this was the next step, that to open up, like, say, regional bakeries around the country where we had no control was not the route I wanted to. But if I wanted to grow the business, opening up this new concept, because I think that there was only one other competitor at that time on the market, was a way that I could oversee it and have much more control.
Got it.
And so this investment banker gave us a lot of money. We were able to build this plant. And at that time, start to look for a larger company that wanted to buy. It was sort of baby steps.
Got it. Okay.
And by the time we did find a company that wanted to purchase not only what we were doing locally, but also this par-baked product, I was ready.
Okay.
It was already much bigger than I had ever dreamed. And let's face it, I got a nice chunk of money.
And that is important in all of this, too.
So
after selling the bakery, you left Campanile and you started your partnership and creating the Mozza restaurants. That's another big period of change. Were you ready to create something new? Were you ready to do something different? What was the impetus for making that big leap?
Well, when I left Campanile, I certainly wasn't ready to retire. And I didn't really know what I wanted to do. While I was on my little summer retreat in my home in Umbria, I had a chef over to my house for dinner, Jeremiah Tower. When I used to eat at Chez Panisse back in the mid-70s, Jeremiah Tower was the chef at Chez Panisse. Fast forward, you know, I don't know, 20 years later. He is living in the same region that I am living in Umbria, and so I needed
casual.
To. Yeah.
You said, come on over for lunch?
Well, I had read into, I don't know who it was, his publicist or somebody that was connected who reminded me or told me that Jeremiah is living, you know, a couple towns over. And I foolishly said, oh, my God, I got to have him over for lunch. It's like, so he calls. And I'm like, what did I just do? I invited Jeremiah Tower to my house for lunch. What am I going to make him?
And what did you make
him? So I served him a very simple lunch. I had just been at a Casaficio where they made mozzarella. And so I bought a bunch of mozzarella and I brought it back to my house. I thought, I'm going to do a non-cooking lunch. It's hot in the summer. Who wants to eat midday, you know, a roast? Not me. So I sort of made mozzarella be the star of our meal, and I made all sorts of things and toasts and condiments to go with mozzarella. And when you have a meal that's so simple and there's so many flavors that you get to, you know, eat and experience, it just sort of adds to the conversation and the fun and the livelihood. And we just had a great lunch. And at the end of the lunch, he said, you know, there's a restaurant in Rome that just opened called Obica, and it has a mozzarella bar, and they do exactly what you're doing.
That you would just hit on naturally.
Yeah, that I just hit on.
Because you didn't want to make him a roast in the middle of the day.
Right, because I didn't want roast in August. But he said, you must go to it in Rome. He said, it's not quite as sophisticated as this, but it's still delicious, and mozzarella is the star of the meal. And I was very intrigued by it. And I assumed by the name and when I went to it, kind of the graphics, that it was owned by a Japanese company that came to Rome to open a restaurant, and which that wasn't. It was an Italian company who went to Tokyo, fell in love with sushi.
And like the concept, but for mozzarella.
Right, which is exactly what it is. Obica is sort of the sushi bar of cheese.
That's amazing.
So I went to Rome, loved the concept, came back to the United States and thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to open a small restaurant with a small counter, that I go back to the days at Michael's where I do everything by myself, and I serve cheese. And that was my concept.
And how did that turn into Mozza? Because I've been to the pizzeria, I've been to Osteria. They're wonderful restaurants, but they're not a small.
No, it's not me by myself.
It's not a small situation where it's just you.
You know, I came back to Los Angeles, enthusiastic about this idea, and I ran into my future partners. Mm-hmm. And with them and their ambitions, my little dream of having a small counter with me behind it kind of changed into an empire. And so that's really what happened.
Got it. So we also talk about hiring quite a bit on this podcast because I think that it's one of those – no one really teaches you how to do it. It's something – I'm sure there's actually a class in it, but I've never taken it. And it's something that I have learned through trial and error how to hire better and what to look for. What is your process like? Are you good at hiring?
Well, I'll tell you, I don't hire anymore. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the aspects that I've delegated, right? You know, again, because I like to look at the cooks or the heads of the kitchen as the people that work for and with them. And so I want them to choose the people
that
they want to work with. But when I did hire, I think for me it was that I wanted to know why the people were applying to work in my restaurant or in my kitchen. I want to make sure that they want to be there because what I'm cooking is what they want to cook. I want to hear from them that they've eaten my food. Mm-hmm. They know what I'm cooking, and that's why they've chosen to work here.
Got it. Okay. So I mentioned this when you first walked in, but I love Nancy's Fancy. How did you decide to start your own line?
I've been making ice cream, now making gelato, since my days at Michael's. So from working at Michael's, I knew at Spago that I was going to make my own ice cream there, moving on to Campanile the same. And then in opening Mozza, I changed the formula a bit to make it more of an Italian texture and flavor and making gelato. There was a company in Los Angeles called LA Creamery, and actually our valet company, the owner, was a partner in that company at that time. He asked me to start a secondary line for them, one that was a little bit higher price because of the ingredients, but also different than what they were doing already. So they're doing all the business, all the legwork, all the marketing. I'm just providing the recipes.
But that's not a small thing because peanut butter is next level.
It's the fun part of it.
What one is your favorite?
You know, I think that one of my favorites is the passion fruit.
Oh, it's so good.
I like really, really strong flavors. And we're doing one right now, a Meyer lemon and Tironi, which is really, really good. So I guess I like those strong, vibrant, acidic flavors.
Interesting. Okay. Well, then that means more peanut butter for me. So in 2014, you won the James Beard Outstanding Chef Award. And you'd won other distinctions in the past, but this is sort of the big one. And I thought it was interesting that in your chef's table interview, you had mentioned that it made you uncomfortable to receive that level of an award. And I was wondering if you've grown more comfortable with that recognition over time, or if you still have some imposter syndrome about it.
I think I still have the imposter syndrome to it, you know?
Why is that? Because you're so accomplished. And I feel like most men certainly would own it proudly. But as women, we tend to shy away from it a little bit. And I'm wondering why that is for you.
Because I think that my skill level doesn't really justify that sort of award. It's not that I couldn't bring my skill level up. I just don't practice it enough. So I think someone that really deserves that award and can really sort of fulfill every job in every part of one's kitchen.
So you think because you don't break down the pig
exactly
that you don't deserve
it?
You know that that's crazy, right?
No.
Okay, well, we all have different standards right. that we hold ourselves to. Okay, so two final questions. One going back to favorites. Of all of the dishes that you've created, breads, desserts, pizzas, chopped salads, everything that you've ever made in the course of your career, what are you most proud of?
I'd have to take it back to something in the bread world, like one of those loaves of bread, again, because the work that went into it. So I'm going to have to say my sourdough baguette.
And last but not least, my favorite question, if you could go back in time and speak with younger Nancy at some point in her earlier career, what advice would you give her?
I think it would be keep on doing exactly what you're doing, because I think I did it right. I think I worked hard. I think that I respected the people that and appreciated the people that I worked with. I think that I didn't take my success for granted. And I think that I always loved and I continue to love what I do. So I think that in that respect, I would say in your work life, don't change anything you've done. But I'm keeping that to your work life, by the way, or my work life.
That was chef, baker, restaurateur, and author Nancy Silverton. For more inspiring interviews with women like Nancy, head on over to secondlifepod.com. If you like today's show, please, 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 please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us and maybe say something nice about us. It makes a huge difference and we very much appreciate it. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and now you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Twitter and Instagram. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show, so send in your request to hello@secondlifepod, or you can DM me on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, or again, you can DM at Second Life Pod. You have many options. The lines are open. We are listening. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.